This is Jake Rosen. I'm here with my son David, and we're talking about politics. Actually, we're arguing about politics. Well, sometimes we're talking, sometimes we're arguing. Why don't you join us?
Well, hello again, world. This is David Rosen. I'm here with my dad, Jake, and we're talking politics around the dining room table in the kitchen. And last night was the third presidential debate. There's so much on the radio and the news media talking about how people interpreted the debate and what their takeaways were on the debate from different points of view and different demographics. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. But, Dad, you've got a great perspective on these things. Does this time in politics, is this completely singular? Or does it remind you of anything throughout the past in terms of social movements or just the political scene as we see it today?
You mean in America, the American political scene?
Yes.
Well, it has certain unique aspects to it. But what's not unique is the rise of this right-wing movement. We've always had these right-wing movements. There's always been stronger or weaker, or nationally strong or regionally strong racist movements, populist movements. Don't forget the Democratic Party in the South for two-thirds of the 20th century was a racist party.
Well, that's two different things. There's an anti-government movement, and then there is a movement that sees government as an enabler of affirmative action, welfare programs, that takes on an anti-government tilt from a racial perspective. But these have always been two separate things.
Well,
an overlap.
It's not exactly true that the right wing was never anti-government or even was always anti-government. Today, there's a stream of the right wing that's anti-government. And that comes out of the libertarian thought of Ayn Rand, which started in the 1950s and took root in the 1960s. But that was when she was active intellectually, and that's when she got her followers and built up this libertarian movement and trained a small core of people, but they were influential.
So there
was a fellow in New York, Murray Rothbard, he happened to have been a friend of mine, who was Ron Paul's teacher and initiator into the libertarian movement, and they built this libertarian movement into a pretty strong movement using the Republican electoral machine. That's how they built it. But they were countered at all times in the past by what was a pretty strong left-wing movement. If we deal with the period from the 30s and the 40s, then we had a strong left-wing movement that centered around the Communist Party and socialism. The McCarthy period knocked that out, and there was no left-wing movement, but there was also no right-wing anarchist movement. The right-wing movement was the government. The anti-communist movement was the government throughout the 50s. In the 60s, with the Cuban Revolution, which had an enormous impact in the United States, especially among young people, but also it revived the spirits of millions of people who had been left-wing in the 40s and who got frightened and scared out of politics in the 50s. They came back into politics inspired by the defense of the Cuban Revolution. And then, of course, came the movement against nuclear weapons, and then came the Vietnam War and the movement against the Vietnam War, and that revived the left and produced a new left. So at that time, there were right-wing movements, but in the 60s, they were overwhelmed by the left, which was much stronger. But of course, the left didn't control the government.
So right now, though, going back to the present situation, would you say that the right-wing movements have more energy and animation, or that the left-wing movements, people like Black Lives Matter and the Bernie Sanders voters and perhaps even the Hillary coalition, which of them is really energized and organized and poised to take a stand in the next 5 or 3 years?
The Hillary coalition is not a left-wing movement. The Bernie Sanders is sort of a left-wing movement. The Bernie Sanders movement hopes to introduce a liberal, social democratic political stream within electoral politics using the Democratic Party. This is a policy, this is a strategy that was originated in the late 1930s by the Communist Party and has been pursued by leftists ever since. It's never succeeded. But anyway, that's what he's trying to do. The Black Lives Matter movement is an important movement, but it is not a movement that unites all Americans. It only unites a section of Americans. It doesn't even seek to unite all Americans, and it doesn't have as a goal what has traditionally been the goal of the left, which was socialism. What it has as a goal is reforming racist practices, especially police racist practices, in the existing system. No movement has ever had a national effect that hasn't had a more encompassing anti-capitalist vision. Without that anti-capitalist vision, nobody ever found a way to unite the disparate reform elements that people fight for. So people fight for this reform element or that reform element, but they never unite.
So basically, we live in a time where the stakeholders on the right have have sort of a direction.
I'm not so sure they have a direction. The stakeholders on the right, if you, by that you mean the people that Trump appeals to and is trying to organize, they don't have a direction. Their direction is a longing for the 1950s. That's not a direction.
So you would say that this election reminds you of the 1950s. And people have said that Trump and his foreign policy, you know, even though it's hard to understand what, if any, policies he has other than his ego and protecting it. But if he has a foreign policy, this idea when he says things like NATO members need to pay up and, you know, basically shying away from blanket internationalism, if you will, is reminiscent of Republican-held ideals or commonly held ideals in the 50s?
After World War II, the Republican Party was split into two parts. There was an isolationist wing, had a long history. After World War II, it was led by a man named Robert Taft. He tried to become the candidate for president of the Republicans. He ran against Dwight Eisenhower. Dwight Eisenhower represented the internationalist wing, the interventionist wing of the Republican Party. Dwight Eisenhower's wing was the New York banks.
All right, so I understand that. So Trump, let's say he wasn't an effing moron. Can I say that on the radio?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, let's say he wasn't that and he could speak in sentences. Do you think that this Taft-like non-interventionist movement is going to be a player over the next 4 years?
Yeah, I don't
think
Trump gets his foreign policy thought, because he doesn't have two. He has one.
All right.
I don't think he gets it from the Taft wing of the Republican Party, because I don't think he knows anything about it. I think he gets it from the right-wing libertarian movement. His point of view is not terribly different than Ron Paul's. Not Rand, but Ron, the father. His point of view. If you remember, when Ron Paul ran for president, he was against intervening anywhere. He was against going into the Middle East. He was against having military bases. This is a stream of right-wing anarchist thought.
And why do people like the Clintons and the Obamas and even the Bushes, why do they have so many foreign entanglements?
Because they represent the banks, the finances, the financiers. Their interest is to see to it that the financiers can invest their money everywhere in the world. That's why they're interested in the freedom of the seas, so that they can trade everywhere in the world. Their whole impetus, and this is the main line of American capital from the end of the 19th century forward, spread out throughout the world and use the government, the American government, the American army, the American diplomacy, American foreign economic relations, to ease the way for American corporations to do business wherever they wish.
So you would say that the things that Clinton won't want to do are to make sure that the bankers of our country can make sure that their notes don't default in places such as Brazil or places such as Saudi Arabia or wherever they are.
Yeah, their role is to make the world safe for American capital. That's their role.
So that they get their money back.
Well, so they can invest their money. And they want it back, of course. They want the profit. But the main thing and the first thing is you got to be able to put it out to begin with. You don't have to worry about getting it back. You want the investment opportunity. You want to make sure that the Russians will allow you to invest in Russia, that the Saudis will allow you to invest in Saudi Arabia, that the Russians will buy from America, that the Russians will buy from that the Saudis will buy from America.
So our Cuba policy is based on the idea that we can one day lend loans and collect interest.
That's
on
the
Cuba.
Whole idea. There's no other idea. That's the idea. The danger of the communist revolution is
they won't pay us back.
No, they won't let you invest.
Oh.
They won't let you in. That's the point. When the Soviet Empire existed, half of Europe was barred to American investment. All of China was barred to American investment.
Now, I don't understand. Why is that bad? I mean, what is investment? What's wrong
that
with
is
investment?
That is how bankers make a living. That is what investment is. That's how.
So I'm a bank. I have $1 billion. You're a business in Mexico, and I have NAFTA. Why? I mean, so I'm going to lend you $1 million and you're going to pay it back to me at 5% interest? That's what's going to happen?
That's what's going to happen. Or whatever interest. Plus fees. Plus whatever. Yes, that's what's going to happen. That's how I make a living.
And that's what all of this is about.
That's what all of it this is about. It used to be about being able to sell goods. But that still exists. But that's not the main thing. The main thing is the right to invest. And you can see how concerned they are when Chinese capitalists come to America and try to invest. They don't make it, the American government doesn't make it easy for them. They don't want them here.
Well, Clinton got in trouble for facilitating a uranium mine sale to the Russians.
Well, all right, there you go. There you go. Now, some of that is just crazy ideology because a lot of these people, they can't tell that Russians are no longer communists. For them, Russians are always bad.
But they're the enemy regardless.
But they're the enemy regardless. That's right. But from another point of view,
they do have nuclear missiles pointed at us.
That's true, but that's a vestige of the past. There's no particular reason
I would have to take issue with you there. It's not necessarily a vestige from the past. The START Treaty has been violated, and they're
but not by the Russians. The START Treaty was violated by the Americans because the key to the START Treaty was that the plutonium had to be destroyed. And the Russians destroyed the plutonium. But the Americans announced that they were not going to destroy the plutonium. They were going to store the plutonium.
Well, are you
so
really
Putin
saying that,
that
Putin's stance is less bellicose and more
on this issue,
pacifist?
He's not pacifist, no. But on this issue, he's carrying out the terms of the treaty, and the Obama administration violated the terms of the treaty. And so the Obama administration and Mrs. Clinton, the Secretary of State, who was involved in all of this, said storing it is tantamount to destroying it. But guess what? If I destroy something, I can't use it again. But if I store something, I can go grab it and use it again. The treaty says destroy.
All right, so going back to where we started, historically, you think that this somewhat resembles the 50s. That was 70 years ago. In terms of right now, how do you see the third debate last night? How did you interpret it?
Well, before I get to the debate, let me tell you this.
Yeah.
The big issue that the left confronted, and this is the big argument that's going on today between people who supported Bernie and people who support Jill Stein. And that debate is, should you try to capture the Democratic Party, and can you capture the Democratic Party and make that into an instrument of progressive politics, or is that impossible?
Well, I've had this argument many times with many people and many of your friends, and I've come to a conclusion. I came to that conclusion when we went to the Democratic National Convention, and my personal conclusion, is that a worse leader does not make us better. That if you have a Trump in power or a George W. Bush, it doesn't help the left.
But that's not the issue.
Yeah, it is.
No, not necessarily.
But it is.
All right, that is the issue. But that's sidestepping the question.
No, it's not.
But because your answer is that the question shouldn't be asked.
No, it's not. My conclusion is that, you know, the people on the ultra left just hate the center, and they'd rather see
who's
their...
Who's the ultra left? What does that mean?
All right, listen, without the semantic stuff, you know.
Forget the ultra left. There are
Bernie Sanders people who will say that it's better to have Trump because then we can, it'll get worse, and then we can really, really rally the troops, really rally the people.
I don't think Bernie Sanders people say that.
That is the line of the left, the people that you're talking about, the Jill Stein people.
The Jill Stein and not the Bernie Sanders people. That's my point. That's it. There's two different groups
here.
Yes,
your left had so many colors and so many labels.
Not my left. Today, there's one group of people who say, build a third party, do not work within the Democratic Party. There's another group of people, like you, who say, forget building a third party, can't be done, build the Democratic Party and capture it for the left. Those are the two competing positions on the left as far as electoral politics are concerned. There's yet a third position, which says electoral politics isn't all that important.
Okay. Well, what about that position? I mean, certainly when there has been great social change, it wasn't that the political leaders, you know, led the change. It was that the actors forced the political leaders into doing whatever they did.
In fact, there's a famous anecdote about Franklin Roosevelt. Now, this is when the people that you would regard as the left controlled the government.
Right.
And Franklin Roosevelt had a conference with some union people, and they talked about whatever they talked about. And the union people said, we need this policy. And Roosevelt said, all right, you've convinced me. I'll support the policy. Now go out and force me to do it. So it had nothing to do with party politics. It had always to do with the movement in the street. And you can say that and from that point of view, provided you don't have a fascist country with a fascist government, that is to say an authoritarian government that operates with police terror and is wholly devoted only to the interests of the corporations, and any disagreement gets you locked up immediately. As long as you have some semblance of democracy, you can have public meetings, you can actually picket, you can carry out demonstrations. They don't kill reporters. If you have that situation, you can say it doesn't matter really which party is in power. If you can organize a strong enough social movement, if you can strike, if you can stop the economy, if you can bring the cities to a standstill.
But there are degrees of difference, because you could have freedom of speech, but the national government can be investing the entire national budget into a war around the world. And
yeah,
you know,
I agree with you. The aim of all of this is to capture control of the government. That's true. That's the aim of all of it.
So if they're doing these things, bankrupting the country and, you know, creating, you know, impoverished classes and whatnot, then, you know, that should be avoided. I mean, it's creating...
But you can't avoid it. You don't have the power to avoid it. But the whole point is you're trying to get the power.
Yes, but in going back to the Jill Stein question, should the Jill Stein people vote for Hillary Clinton? The answer is that if you actually see yourself as a member of a country and you don't want that country, you know, whether or not the risk of a Trump presidency is real or, you know, not that dangerous at this moment because of his low popularity, but, you know, when people like George W. Bush take power, what happens is you end up, you know, even more aggressively representing the military-industrial complex, even more...
You mean the government does?
Right.
Yeah, but when George W. Bush took power and he wanted to go into Iraq, on one given day, the left managed to bring millions of people into the street.
That's right.
All over the country.
Multiple times.
Multiple times.
We were there.
That's right. Don't do this. He did it anyway. The leadership of the left and of that anti-war movement fell apart. That was very bad. That's not a given. That's not an inevitability. The point is, why didn't that movement of the many millions continue? Why didn't it grow? Why didn't they say, well, this guy is in office, we'll go into office? Then the question of electoral politics might have come up for that movement, and it would have been, you know, something useful to consider.
Well, Barack Obama won the presidency based on a movement that he wasn't behind that war. And Hillary Clinton suffered for it.
That's right. And not only that, but that he was the incarnation of the success of the civil rights movement.
Right.
So he inherited the 60s left. That's what happened. That's exactly right. And so all of the old leftists and a lot of the new would-be leftists said, he's our savior. Because they didn't have the experience that you had to do it yourself in the streets with your comrades and colleagues and friends and neighbors and family members. There are no saviors. They are like Franklin Roosevelt said, now go out and make me. Well, they didn't have that experience. They thought, oh, this guy's come along and now everything will be hunky-dory. And it turned out to be worse.
Well, that's very interesting. So what we're saying today, what you're saying and I'm accepting, is that Politics is not a problem for politicians. Politics is led by the people, and the politicians are moved by the people.
That's right. Politics is social action in behalf of social policy. In the final analysis, it's to put politicians in power who support the needs and interests of working people, who only make up about 95% of the population, and don't need to fight wars with other working people, and are not interested in competing with other working people. They're interested in collaborating and cooperating with it.
All right. Well, and if that's the case, then let's talk about the politicians, because we have a few different funny things to talk about. We've got about 10 minutes left of programming. So there's two big questions I have. Maybe three. One question I have is, what do you think the different groups, the different demographics who watch this debate take away from the debate? Because I think some people say Trump wins, or some people say Clinton was great, and some people say Trump was terrible. How awful was he? But others say he wasn't that bad. And then the next question I have is, how does this affect the national picture to the best of our ability and the time we have? And lastly, where do we go from here with respect to knowing what we know about all of these different factions? What do you think the future looks like?
Well, I can tackle that one.
Okay.
Because I listened very closely to Hillary Clinton. I think Hillary Clinton is a shoo-in. I don't think there's any way she can lose the election. Doesn't mean that the Congress will be Democratic, or the Senate will be Democratic, and that will limit what she can accomplish. But I heard her say very clearly she's planning on going to war in Syria. She talked about the fact that she wants a no-fly zone in Syria. And when Chris said to her, well, what about the Russians? Her answer was, well, we'll explain it to them. We'll explain it to them.
What do you think her perspective is on U.S. military power?
She thinks U.S. military power is overwhelming and can't be beaten. She thinks that it can be relied upon. She thinks the Russians can be faced down, and that that's a useful thing to do.
Is she right?
No, she's not right.
Why is she wrong?
The reason she's wrong is that because the Russians have it within their ability to inflict enormous casualties on the United States
Army. Who's left?
Nobody's left. Once that happens, very few people will be left, because one escalation will lead to another. Whatever starts outside of Aleppo will end up outside of New York.
No.
Yeah.
You think there will be a world war if...
I think it's conceivable. When war starts, plans go out the window. There's no rationality in war. There's lots of plans. But the one thing about war plans that everybody who's involved with war plans knows is they all fall down as soon as the fighting starts. They're never right. And they can't be. They can only anticipate what they can foresee, but they never foresee what actually happens. She wants to have a no-fly zone. A no-fly zone will mean at least 70 to 90,000 U.S. troops on the ground to protect the no-fly zone. It will mean the fleet in place. It will mean an air force in place. It will mean the missiles in place. It will mean the mobilization of NATO, Turkey, as an important component of it. How's that? Now some
and
Russian
why are we doing that?
And why are we doing that? I give up. Why are we doing that?
To prevent...
What?
The Assad regime from killing the people who want to overthrow him.
Exactly. Who were put... Exactly. And
who he is now calling terrorists.
He's been calling them terrorists from the word go. And guess what? Most of them are. Most of this... It's true that there are millions of Syrian people who fled the fighting. That's exactly true. Guess what? There are 15 to 18 Syrian people who did not flee the fighting. And of those 15 to 18 million Syrian people, nearly three-quarters or 80% of them support Assad. They don't like Assad. They hate Assad. But they support that government.
Right.
They do not wish to have an Islamist government ruling them. Not any sort of Islamist government. Assad runs a secular country. They don't want to not live in a secular... They may want to be religious. They may not want to be religious. They don't want
All right,
to live in a religious
so
country.
We only have so much time. Going beyond the world war that you think is going to happen.
Well, I don't know if it'll happen, but I know that it's a great danger listening to Mrs. Clinton.
So she's putting that chip on the table.
She said it. She
Trump,
said it.
For all his bluster, who says, why not threaten this, that, and the other, isn't threatening anything, and she's threatening everything.
That's exactly right. Now, whether Trump would actually be able to do what he wants, or would he have to give in to the Republican bankers and carry out a foreign policy identical to Mrs. Clinton's, that I don't know. I know what he says, but the fact that he says it doesn't mean that he would actually have the power to do it once he got in office. Then he'll be the captive of a lot of people, a lot of forces that he doesn't think he has to pay attention to now, but he will have to pay attention to. But what I know is that what he says is completely different than what Mrs. Clinton says.
All right, so moving beyond Syria, what do you think is interpreted by the different news, the different components of the population when they see these debates, when they see Trump talk, when they see Clinton talk, not just who won and who lost, but how do you think it's interpreted? You have a broad...
I think that when a lot of working people hear Trump, they say that he's speaking to working class.
Are you kidding me? I mean...
I'm not kidding you. I think they listen to him and they say, this guy is speaking to working class needs because he has he grabs their grievance. You lost your job. Pay is no good. There doesn't seem to be a lot of hope. He's grabbed that grievance and he's ascribed it to a wrong cause. These are the crappiest trade deals that were ever made. Trade deals didn't make these jobs go away. Capitalist industrialization made these made these jobs go away. The solution to it is not building a wall or going after immigrants. The solution to it is socialism. I don't think he'll say that.
What do you think across the United States, where Arizona may now be in play, and you know, where it looks like the possibility for an incredible landslide victory for Hillary Clinton exists? Based on what most people say is the incredibly regressive personal habits of Mr. Trump.
Yeah, because I think most Americans are anti-racist and anti-sexist. Good for us. That's good. They reject that. They reject the crap that he puts out in that way. They may feel that he has put his finger on a problem, but they reject him as being a sexist and a racist. And they reject the policy of being racist and sexist.
And also being stupid.
Well,
he doesn't know how to speak a sentence.
Well, all right.
The Second Amendment, the judges will do what the framers wanted the frame shop to deliver in the Constitution.
He went to school in Queens. You can't help it. Anyway, we'll talk more about some interesting questions.
Well, just before we go, you know, all right, so you don't have a lot of faith for Hillary because you take her very much at her word and you think there's going to be incredible international...
Well, because I don't think she'd be able to achieve anything domestically because I don't think she'll be able to get anything through the Congress.
What if the Congress is Democratic?
It's not going to be Democratic.
What if it is?
The Senate may be Democratic.
So what if you have two?
What?
Oh, so she can't do anything with a weakened House and a Democratic Senate?
If she can't get it through the House, it doesn't matter if she gets it through the Senate. She's got to get... The only thing that counts if she gets through the Senate is appointments, Supreme Court appointments.
Well, that counts.
That does count, but I'm talking about legislation. Where legislation is concerned, she's not going to get anything done. What she can get done is what she can do by executive action. Making war is what she can do.
Well, what about other social programs? I mean, what do teachers think is going to happen, you know, going forward? Or, you know, are there any parts of this country that will benefit in a good way from the victory of the left-leaning Democratic Party over the right-leaning obstructionist global warming?
I don't think the Democratic Party is left-leaning. I think it's right-leaning.
But it's to the left of the Republicans.
But they're both on the right. It's true. It stands to the left on the right. But they're both right-wing parties. They're both corporate parties. They're both bankers' parties. They're both investors' parties. And I know that Bernie scored a great victory with the platform, but I don't believe that the Democratic administration will have any interest in implementing the platform or any ability to implement the platform.
Well, there you go, people. The debate might as well have not happened. It's a false choice.
I don't say that, but it is a false choice. That I do
say. See?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Thank you very much. And thank you for this half hour of your time this week. We look forward to talking to you next week from our kitchen to yours.
See you next week.